Colonel Likely, Reel 10. You left the feature that you'd originally been on at what date? Do you recall the date?
I think it was about the beginning of December, I think.
And where did you go then?
We came back to another of these areas, which I think was called Area 16. What do I remember about Area 16? It was certainly a battalion. I recall it, so my impression of it, the battalion was on its own, but that we had, after an officer's mess, I wasn't much else. The CEO had a command truck, it was like a caravan thing. That was the, I remember seeing this thing just up on the hill, it's a trailer or command truck. And we had a great problem keeping warm. I mean, I shared a tent with Mike McBain, Colonel McBain, who sadly died this long ago. And he was a regular soldier. And we had three tents. We had one inside the other, and a small tent, the bigger one, the bigger one. And in the very middle of this, we had this stove burning a red hot. I mean, it actually had horrendous reach of all the health and safety regulations you think of. That's how we kept it on. And maybe I remember that is waking up one morning to see a very yellow Mike McBain looking at me, and he developed jaundice when my teacup was away off to hospital, and that's last resort then. Had to go back to hospital.
What were you doing there?
We were in training again, and again working on defensive lines. It was very quite hard winter by now, I think. And we were, again, quite a lot of these exercises where you did patrols against each other, and you rehearsed exercises while you were going in to support companies who were being attacked in the front line.
Had you been issued with snow clothing since you had snow on the ground?
No, I mean, we had the same clothing all the time. But I think there were a number of these very lightweight white coveralls you could get to put on the top of them. We didn't get them. I think they were there if you wanted them for patrol or something like that. I don't think they were on general issue. We got our bulletproof vests, which were quite encouraging. They were like, it's like a sleeveless vest you put on, and they were like Bakelite, you know what I mean, like plastic plates, overlapping plastic plates, which we all have great faith in. I never actually put them to the test, but it made you feel quite important. It came down to about your waist, your arm will have feet.
But you never really found out whether they worked efficiently or not.
No.
Nor would you want to.
They did. And we used to make people wear steel helmets on the line. We were quite strict about that. That was because water bombs and shrapnel. I think they would have stopped that sort of thing. Well, they would have stopped the bullet at close range. I don't know. But, I think shrapnel would be okay.
Sporting and leisure activities, were they taken up in this brief?
Yes, again, the normal things. Inter-platoon competitions of football, and I think there was even some of the officers went on a pheasant shoot back down the other day, because we had some pheasants over Christmas, which the colonel and one or two of them who were keen shots went and did. I think they bought their shotguns through the nappy. They didn't want to bring them out from home with them. I think they got them from there, but they seemed to have 12 balls. Often do things. Plenty of game wildlife like that about this place.
Were there any civilian?
I went on leave, of course. I went to Japan.
And that was during this December period, was it?
Yes, it was before Christmas. It happened in Marvis. I think I got about 2 hours notice that I was going on leave with a man called George Hill. And we went back to somewhere near Seoul. By military transport, and met up with another bunch of people going on leave, Americans, Australians, Canadians, Turks, all sorts, and got in this great big flying box car. wasn't like a departure lounge at Newcastle Airport. It's nice. Sat on the in the big hangar, and not in there, a lot of seat there. You sat on the at the bottom of this plane, and were then flown into the middle of Tokyo around the full embassy. It's like opening a magic box, you know. The doors opened and you came out into bright light, marvellous. And we got issued with a proper battle dress again, clean shirts, underwear, uniform with our medal ribbons on and things all fine. Pay office there who paid his money, and then into taxis on the way down to the bright lights, hot baths, lavatories that flushed and were warm. It's amazing how little things like that you appreciate. It's absolutely superb. And we had a wonderful time. George, in fact, had an uncle who lived in Yokohama. He'd been an insurance broker there before the war. And he'd been interned, in fact, during the war in Tokyo. And it had really been checked quite well. And there seemed to be civilians who'd been interned, different just soldiers who surrendered. I don't know if it was part of their culture, but George's uncle reckoned that he'd been treated pretty fairly, and he got some Russians to what the Japanese had. And certainly at the end of the war, when he went back to his house, there was an inventory there with all the contents listed, everything, teapots, teaspoons, everything was all still there. So he got all of that. And that's rather surprising, actually. Because we used to go shopping in Yokohama, and I bought a dinner set for 120 pieces from a street trader, a stall in the street, who claimed to have supplied babies in Newcastle for the war, and showed me some invoices to him, in fact. And all this was just left. I left the money with him and the address to Margaret, my now wife, who then lived in Morpeth. And duly all arrived, beautifully packed and boxed. It was little notes and then things broken, bring it back. And George's uncle said, now, he said, whenever you buy anything from them, be quite confident that they will not cheat you, they'll do an honest deal. And that was my experience.
And the Japanese themselves, by and large, did they treat you okay? It wasn't long after the war.
Oh, no. In fact, we went to Hiroshima to look at the bomb damage. Yeah, we went actually to the center where the epicenter of the explosion had been. And no one treated any differently other than all the other tourists who were there. Not only were we doing anything disrespectful, but you did find odd things, like you find the nuclear nightclub or the atomic bar and things like that. And obviously, as far as they were concerned, we were people with lots of money to spend. So we worked in fact, restaurants and shops and so on. There's magnificent shops in Tokyo at that time, as far as we were concerned. And it was Christmas, coming up to Christmas, so all the Christmas goodies were on display, and Christmas lights. And it was our first time in and countrywide, in fact, you couldn't really guess what the words in the neon lights said. Probably said Omo or Daz or Cult, but it just looked like pussy lights. And the policemen had lanterns in their head, directing traffic with black paper lanterns. And all very nice. And so we used to travel up and down from Yokohama into the Ginza on these very, very fast trains. That's like the bullet train, but they were extremely good rail service back in there. And George's uncle had a car, so we went out to see Fujiyama, we went out to see some lakes, and we went out to concerts in the Japanese theatre. And it was quite fantastic, really.
Was there still were there still signs of damage and destruction from the bombing?
No, not where we were. No. There wasn't yoga in the Hiroshima. It was all flat in the middle of Hiroshima. But Tokyo didn't seem to be damaged or be all being rebuilt. We were certainly in the Ginza, which was like the west end of.
Was this an army base, a leisure centre for the army?
It was a big reception camp where you went to, and you could stay there, but I think 99% of people immediately decamped from that and went and stayed in hotels in Tokyo and stayed with friends like we did. So we really only stayed there the first day we arrived, whilst we got kitted out and collected our back 6 months pay or something. And then we went back again to get organised to go back again.
There's lots of soldiers of all ranks and money. The prostitution must have been pretty rife.
Oh, yes. Nightclubs, massage parlours, baths. Turkish baths, you know, they're quite special. Got these baths, and you had to get washed before you got in the bath. And you sat in the bath, and these girls would come and play music and bring you beers and things like that. And if I used to cost about half a crown or something. They would take your uniform away and boots and things and clean them and polish them off. Get back polished. You know. So we should all spend the morning or afternoon or something. I think there would be one or two people came back with things like VD. It wasn't a serious problem. It
wasn't serious in the battalion, was it?
No, I think everyone got talked to by the end before they went. So, you know, I think you want to do it. It was very funny. There was a big American base not far from Seoul, which we used to pass regularly on transport going back and forth to Asia. And they used to have a cricket scoreboard thing outside. And they used to say something like, through the gates past the Thunderbirds, you know, the best troops in the world, and said, no VD for 3 days. And then we got done 3 days. And this was on the main road, you know, in the A1. So they all thought they were a bit strange. Like.
Did the other ranks get the same amount of leave as the officers?
All the same. I think it was five. Better be 5 days on and out, we're told. Rest and recuperation, as we're told, is lodger and rape or something. Most people didn't get very much sleep or rest. It was pretty hectic, but tremendous experience to all the young lads. You know, particularly to come straight from the line actually into that and then back again. It was like you were there in 2 hours, you know.
You'd be back with the battalion for Christmas, were you?
Yes.
And was it the traditional British Army Christmas that you had?
Yes, we did, yes, yes. We had the mess was very, very comfortable. It really was. We set fire to it, actually, just about the night that we were leaving. And the incoming unit left with us. Well, the burnt shell, I seem to recall, but we certainly had a very nice Christmas.
Shortly after,
Christmas communion, that sort of thing.
Messages from home, and
yes. In fact, I think I appeared on Passé News. It was the B Company were dishing out the Christmas lunch, and I was on there. And my aunt, who was in fact my adopted mother, if you like, I think I told you before, my mother died. But, I think she was in the cinema and called her Green or something like that. And she shouted out, oh, there's our John or something. Now they're doing this thing and just got the Christmas lunch.
Traditional Christmas lunch?
Yes, it was, yes, turkey and mustard, yeah.
Shortly afterwards, you went back into the line.
Yes.
Where was this?
We went back to 210159, which was like a long hogback ridge going down from 210 down to 159, and it was to the left of 355. And 4 Platoon, which was at the very, very bottom end. And I thought it was a rather nice place, and I thought it was very comfortable. And, it seemed to be very peaceful, actually. And it was about 4 or 5 years ago. I was talking to Peter Jeffries one night back here at home. And he said, oh, I used to worry about that position in the old joint. And it was, I was quite convinced they would take it up because it was so isolated. I hadn't realised this at the time, and I said, I'm glad you didn't tell me it's the shop. I thought it was really nice. And it really was quiet. And but if you look on the map now, in fact, it's right at the bottom of the spur. It's a right-handed spur. You know, you could quite easily just cut the end of it off. There was nothing on the other side to support you.
And did you hold that position for the whole of the time that you were on 255?
Yes, I was on 159. No, we stopped around, I think, and came back a bit to another one again. So only which forward. But I remember that front one very clearly. We were there from New Year's Eve. And one of my members, every New Year's Eve now, I think of Reggie Atkinson. Every New Year's Eve when midnight strikes, because we have to go around, probably these tank controls have radio. And for some reason, they weren't working very well this night. And so Reggie said, you must go around and change all their batteries and check all their batteries. It was quite a job. You had to go out, tramp around in the no man's land to find all these controls and take a bag of new batteries out. So I got back just about midnight, and someone says, no, I've not been out to check, that's right. So well, not early, I came back. And came back, and there was a message saying, would I ring Reggie, you see? So I got back, it must be about 11:30. I thought he was going to say Happy New Year or something. Two of them aren't working, so we're going to have to go do them again. Midnight, I was there trundling out again to replace you. So when I came back, there you were, tucked up in bed asleep. So that was a Happy New Year to Reggie. So I still think of that New Year's Eve. I think I'm changing batteries. And quite an interesting place. I'd say 355 was away from the light of it.
Well, the defensive situation similar to 159 when the original position you were in?
Yes, they were all very similar. I mean, they're almost like the part from the fact that it might be a bit more to left. I think they're all basically the same. There were fighting slip trenches on the forward side of the hill, communication trenches through to the back, where the hutches were. But by this time, of course, we had cookhouses going, proper cookhouses. We had pretty civilised latrines. And we had very good hutches with very good conditions. And we had, my batman. I got young and just started. He's quite a good cook, actually. We had things like chips and little goodies we brought back from Japan, with, you know, like tins of sardines. You got two sardines on toast, you could have taken chips or something. You came back in, you could wash in hot water and shave. And we had, by this time, we had tinny lamps and things, which were warm and well, so you could read, you could write easily, tables and stuff.
Do you recall any particular actions or activities that you got involved with?
I don't know. I had rather peaceful time. I know you wanted to hear about Operation Woodness. I just managed to miss all of it. It was fairly quiet, routine digging and patrolling and improving the defences all the time. I used to walk around that one actually with a walking stick. I used to have a stick and a revolver, and I thought you could just walk around this place. And it's a lovely starry evening. Very, very peaceful. And eventually we were relieved there by the Americans. And they arrived with, about 10 men for everyone that we had. But they didn't fit into the slip trenches or bunkers. And they had things like platoon switchboards for the telephone exchanges and heavy machine guns and master sergeants. And they just seemed to overwhelm us, you know, there were so many of them. And we wandered over to them on a particularly cold night. It really was horrendous. And we came back out. And it was so cold, we came back on these, basically got back to the trucks. Came down this hillside and blizzard of snow and things. terrible night. And then we got in these trucks to go back. And we hadn't gone very far when I was in the front door, was banging on the roof and the cab stopped. And the trucks were freezing in the back. It was so cold, so we had to stop and let them get out. And then they marched for a while and then go back in and they got back. Otherwise, it was just a frozen day. And we hadn't gone very far when we were suddenly stopped. And the place we came out of, the whole thing was lit, there was flares going up, there were machine guns firing, and we thought they'd been overrun, these Americans, so we were told to get out and prepare to dig in on this, you know, middle of nowhere, virtually. So after about an hour of chittering about in the dark and getting fairly depressed and miserable, then we decided it was all a mistake, and nothing was happening at all. We got back in there. And went back to
the Americans just announcing their presence to the Chinese, was that it?
I don't know what it was. No idea, but I mean, they certainly did. No uncertain way about it. I mean, they must have looked like Guy Fawkes Night, you know. And,
what date was this when you came off?
I think it must have been January, February. It was certainly the depths of winter then. We came back to a place called Camp Casey, which was a filthy place, like a divisional reserve. It was quite a long way back on. Yeah, it was beyond where we normally went to. And it was a big tent of camp. It was very, very dirty. And again, we had we had one big marquee with little tents inside it to try and keep warm. And it wasn't very, very far from Seoul then. It must have been about sort of 10 or 12 miles from Seoul. And it was just scruffy. It took us quite a long time to get the place cleaned up and sorted out.
Who had moved out when you moved in?
I can't remember. I think it was Americans, but I'm not sure. But it was. It certainly wasn't a very good idea.
And you had, as you said, a lot of work putting it right.
Yeah, making it clean and comfortable, making sure that the lads were probably looked after. I mean, it wasn't long before they had the company canteens going, and all the Pitlani or the Black Boy and things like that, you know. And Sergeant's mess, corporal's mess, and got them going. And the highlight then is that was really we had a visit from the Prime Minister of New Zealand, Australia, and there's a big parade there with the band that playing bass, and he presented the baton with a bugle. I think it was the New Zealand Prime Minister. He gave the baton a silver bugle from the sister regiments of Canterbury.
And what were you doing there, by and large? What were you doing at Camp Casey?
I think we were back again on this wiring and preparing defence again. Back into the British depot type thing, all the officers and companies were on guard or a fatigue party to the cookhouses. More like the routine you'd expect to better capture them.
Did the men settle in well into this situation?
Yes, once they got themselves tidied up and got themselves warm. I mean, some of them prefer their hoodies because they're really snug in those and sort of large marquee type thing. You know, they're raised off the ground. I think they had the wooden floors and things, but they were a bit spartan after what they'd been used to. And I think by and large they like living as little platoons. You know, they didn't even get bothered so much by RSMs and adjutants and people.
Came a bit regimented spit and polish and all this.
Yes, but there was often spitting and polishing out. So even in the line, every morning we expect a supper. And people did shave and clean the thick wood off their boots and so on, and hair their blankets and everything.
Was again sporting activities, were they taken up?
Oh, yes. When there wasn't snow on the ground, you couldn't go skiing or sledging or anything. But a condition would like to do things like that. And again, more of them went on leave now. Some of them, instead of going to Tokyo, they started now going to a place called Kobe, I think it was a resort in South Korea where they could go to on the coast.
Were there any civilians around this area? Civilian hamlets, villages, what have you?
Yeah. There have been villages, firstly from Camp Britannia all the way back. Very different to what they are now. I've been on the revisit, as you know, quite recently. I've been back twice, in fact, and it's like going to a modern city now. I think it's to the those times, of course, they were in the store thatched mud huts. Very, very well kept, and they had very effective underfloor heating things. They had stores outside, but the hot air was ducted under the huts, so they were quite comfortable. But they used to wear traditional sort of prisoners' clothes and possibly doors. Nothing much of a soul was just cotton, you know, one big cotton soul. So if you went back to Seoul, that was really more than that.
Did you come into contact with the civilians very often?
No, not really. The only one we came in contact with were the ones, you know, we had these porters attached to each platoon. Republic of Korean Pioneer Corps, and they provided two or three porters to each platoon, who were incredibly helpful, and they would carry two jerry cans of water, whereas we had two soldiers to carry one. They would carry them all day up these hills, they were carrying two coils of barbed wire, which must have been a hundredweight and a half. They would carry our rations up on in those big hay boxes. So it was like a band of webbing over the forehead onto a thing called an A-frame. And off you would go, you would go up the hill and they would start trundling on behind you. And almost the time you got there, they would arrive, so we almost went. We couldn't do any of ourselves. Well, we could have done, but it would be very, very difficult.
Did you see or hear of any maltreatment of the civilians by their own army or
South
Koreans?
No, they were much harder than we were. They used to say that the South Korean army did all this training with real bullets, you know. It was the firing exercise. They didn't bother quite as much about safety as we did. And I certainly once saw some Koreans having a kick set, and it was a freezing cold day, and they just simply stripped down to their underpants and held up a shirt, and they would say, shirt, and they would say, how big is it? How big is it? They'd have to hold them up. And, yeah, half of them would have preached them to death, but didn't seem to bother them. But, you can't really leave out our upbringing to them.